political management audit of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is continuing to ripple. The office has no comment about a possible FBI probe. The OHA board is meeting in closed session this morning to talk about the employment contract of CEO Kamanao Crabb, though he won't be there. OHA told us Crabb is on leave until the end of the month, but wouldn't say why or how long he's been out. Some members have called for his removal, but that remains to be seen if the board has the 6 votes to fire him. Former Governor John Wahee sat down with us to talk about the audit and the latest turmoil at the agency. Wahee recently interviewed Crabb on Think Tech Hawaii, a local talk show.
For me, the first thing that came to mind is, what was the purpose of the audit? And I wasn't sure that the purpose of the audit was to make things better or to attack OHA, whether there was in fact a political agenda. And this particular audit is especially suspicious because of the fact that, first of all, the procedures and the like that were, evaluated, the establishment of which was really in the purview of OHA. I mean, this is not something that they didn't read the rules someplace. It was somebody coming in and said, well, Kamanao Crabb, you're the director, you're the procurement officer, but you should never, ever decide differently than your staff. Where's that? Where is that anywhere that the person that's at the top should always listen to the staff?
So your point is that if these are discretionary funds, it's at his discretion?
Well, the point is that they started off by using words like discretionary funds. But in fact, for example, the funds that they targeted had very little discretion in it. It came from the discretionary funds, meaning the name that was given funds that were put aside over the years to be used for various activities. But if you look at the audit, out of the $14 million, $10 million of it were funds taken from that pool to match funds that the legislature put up for state priority programs. In other words, the OHA was essentially required to match the monies.
And you made the point that some of these funds came from the trust fund and they weren't
right. That's
from the general fund.
That's the difference. Now, there are really, loosely speaking, 3 types of funds at OHA. One is funds that you receive as part of the ongoing relationship regarding seeded funds. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is entitled to a pro rata share of all the monies raised on seeded lands. So that is constitutionally required for them to have. In addition to that, you have monies that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs have that were given to them for back wrongs and payments, which are then put into a trust fund, hence the word discretionary, because you can either leave it in there for investment purposes or you can use it to cover ongoing activities. And the third level of funds are funds that are given to OHA from the general fund to do certain types of projects. Now, when the legislature does that, they usually require a matching share. And $10 million of these funds that were the subject of this audit actually were funds that had to be matched against state action. For example, one of the immersion school programs, the legislature would give so much money and say, okay, OHA, you do the rest. The Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation, legislature would give so much money and then say, okay, this is you need to pass it on to the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. Now, that is not something that just happened last year and then they made an audit. That's something that's been going on for 20 years.
Right. You had mentioned that you thought that possibly there were political motives behind the audit. We had the state auditor, Les Kondo, here in our studios, and he defended that audit. You know, he raised the point that, you know, there were, regardless of which pot of money, you know, we were looking at, that there were certain protocols that, and that perhaps they weren't met.
Yeah, I don't think Les Kono was the is part of a political conspiracy. I think that you know, and we didn't get into this during my interview, but I think that there are political problems between the administrator, the executive Kamanao, and the trustees. And I think that some of these trustees are, and so the audit has gotten an importance that it wouldn't otherwise have.
But there's also reports about, you know, this audit getting the attention of the FBI. And so we're not sure, you know, what they might be looking for,
yeah,
if they're fishing
and,
for something.
And how does that get to be as important as it now is? I mean, the FBI, the legislature, and the way they handle things over the years have regularly got the attention of the FBI. The administration has. And I think that sometimes in this day and age, you know, people concede that too easily. I mean, the real issue for me is, what's the probable cause?
Right. Is there wrongdoing?
In the entire audit that Kono did, there really wasn't wrongdoing. It was like wrong thinking or wrong in his opinion.
Well,
but the whole reason for doing OHA was to have beneficiaries decide what is a priority.
Well, my understanding is that OHA is putting the brakes on I think the discretionary funds, to see if there shouldn't be another layer of checks and balances, just, you know, for best practices. You know,
well,
are we doing what we need to do, regardless of whose money it is?
Best practices is one thing, okay, but what's best practices for a cultural institution may be different than best practice for something that's not based on a cultural objective.
Right, and you were involved in the creation of OHA,
right,
several decades ago, and you obviously believe that there is a difference there.
Yeah, I do, because I wanted to make the point. Now, I want to make really clear that I'm not defending any particular action, but I am defending the idea that that somebody else's judgment, that we may think that somebody else's judgment ought to be submitted for people who represent the beneficiary. One area which is especially irritating, I think, is the idea of trustee allowances. You know, each trustee gets $22,000, and that's something that, you know, the public ought to know about and so forth. I have no problem with that. But it's curious. It's curious to me that what wasn't pointed out was the fact that every legislator gets the same $22,000, that every council person, at least on Oahu, gets the same money. So if we are going to do a management audit on that issue, then just the equality alone screams that you ought to look at everybody.
Well, does that auditor's office, though, have the authority to look at legislators' discretionary funds? Because I know in some jurisdictions it's limited.
Well, the legislature always has very conveniently made sure that everybody else gets looked at, but their practices don't. In fact, I hate to say this, but I have been told that one reason why Les is on the is the state auditor now is that the legislature was very unhappy with the way he was looking at their ethics.
Right, when he was
and
with
so,
the ethics
and
commission.
So they moved him over, so now he looks at everybody else's stuff. That still doesn't excuse the fact that if you're going to say something, then let's all be honest about it. Now, having said that, and I, by the way, I have suggested, and I understand some people in the media have already made some information requests for the information on, you know. So the media may have to take the responsibility of seeing what these expenditures are for and how it's being handled. Now, the justification for going up to $22,000 was the idea that mail was expensive. And it takes that much money to communicate with, you know, this is fine.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is each body, including OHA, sort of was responsible for developing their own procedures. So why not look at what these other people spent their money for? Now, having said that, okay, so I'm in total agreement. We ought to look at that. We ought to see it. But we ought to look at everybody's. If you're going to talk about best practices, then let's look at best practices everywhere. We're going to invite the FBI in. Let's invite them in for everybody.
Okay. And then
but here's the thing, though. What is interesting to me is one of the things that was complained about was the fact that a trustee paid for a beneficiary's medical bills. And was that the purpose of this money? Yeah. In my opinion, I don't know. None of the funds, at least that I could identify, and I have to confess, I didn't read the audit, you know, in any great detail, but none of the funds were used for things that would not be considered beneficiary-related or job-related.
Well, how do you think the voters will look at this? Because it's not just Hawaiians that can vote for OHA trustees.
Well, I think that's the real question. Why was this audit done at the time it was done in a way that may affect an election? And then to hear one of my colleagues who normally, you know, we don't necessarily agree, but we do, you know, often enough, you know, to say that, wow, you know, this audit means that we ought to change the way trustees are elected or abolish OHA. As a person who is interested in Hawaiian affairs, I cannot help but suspect that the real objective of the audit was to affect elections or maybe to affect the long-range viability of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs.
So the colleague that you were talking about, former Ben
Cayetano.
Ben. Mm-hmm.
Ben. I mean, I don't know if he actually said it. So somebody told me he said that. But if he did, you know, once again, Ben, you're mistaken.
Well, there have been other calls by some trustees to for folks to step down, including the CEO, Kamanao Crab, and that the board is taking that up. But it remains to be seen. Did he do anything? Was there cause? Is there cause to remove him? If not, I mean, I don't know where the legal counsel was for OHA through some of these.
Yeah,
things.
You know, this is not not a way. I'm more interested in the viability of the institution than in any particular member. Okay, having said that, there may be good reason why the trust, why the CEO ought to be up for a review. I mean, you know, and really, that is one of the primary functions of being a trustee, is to hire someone that you feel comfortable with carrying out the mission that you see OHA doing. So on that issue, I don't have any problem. It's really up to them. Now, do I wish that they could conduct themselves in a much more acceptable manner? Of course. But I have to say this, that at least one trustee on the board of OHA got elected, and prior to being elected, his agenda was to destroy the agency. I mean, Kealii Akina has never hidden that fact, that he doesn't believe that what he calls a race-based agency ought to exist.
Right, and as someone who helped create that agency, you think he's wrong?
Well, absolutely.
Off base on that.
And because for one thing, I don't even think it's race-based. I think that it is a political issue. And that the things that the rights that Hawaiians have would not have been given us, we could not have become a state without agreeing to do those things.
That was former Governor John Wahee talking about the turmoil at OHA. Wahee was the state's first Native Hawaiian governor. The management audit of OHA is required every 4 years. Trustees Kealii Akana and Rowena Akana who are outspoken critics of the CEO, have led the charge on a separate financial audit, which is currently underway. Thank you. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, leaders of education and government gather for a panel on STEM education. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're in Honolulu on the corner of King and Eisenberg Streets. If you're looking for landmarks, this is the intersection where you find a First Hawaiian Bank Center, the Mo'ili'ili Neighborhood Park, Mr. Scooter's Hawaii, and the State Park, named after the sporting structure that exists only in memories and photographs. In 1925, businessman J. Ashman Bevan purchased 14 acres in the neighborhood and built the Honolulu Stadium for around $150,000. Seating capacity wasn't large, only about 25,000, but it officially opened on November 11, 1926. The first event was a football game. For those of you who lived through the era of diners and car hops, there was a popular drive-in located across the street from the so-called Termite Palace that drew large crowds of teens in their souped-up hot rods. It was the place to hang out and chow down on menu favorites like the corned beef hash plate with gravy over everything, thick crinkle-cut fries, and an orange freeze. For today's quiz, can you tell the name? That's the name of the eatery located where the First Hawaiian Bank currently sits. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Are the machines we create evolving faster than we are? Recent advances in science and technology challenge our ability to understand and keep up with them. And for the next generation coming up, that challenge can spell opportunity. That's the perspective of Dr. Peter Grus, President and CEO of the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. He'll be the keynote speaker at a forum this Monday on science, technology, engineering, and math, entitled Views from the Cutting Edge. It's at the East-West Center, and we spoke with him yesterday.
I think what is ahead of us is that technology will revolutionize all our lives. The world in 10, 20 years will look completely different. We will have autonomous cars. We have intelligent machines. We will have smart cities. So the life in 10 to 20 years is going to be a completely different one. And we need people who not only understand it, but who also can transmit what the changes are going to be to our people. So my opinion is that it is of critical importance to have STEM education as early as possible and as intensive as possible.
You know, there's a sense, Doctor, with advances in technology that they frequently outpace our ability to keep up with them. You know, sometimes I feel as if we're chasing technology rather than the other way around. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, but that is due to the fact that not a lot of people understand the intricacies of the technology anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one more reason to educate our people and make that people aware of what these machines can do and what in particular that means for the future of our lives.
The perception in the past, and I'm going back a generation or so, of science, technology, engineering, and math education was that it was kind of dry and unexciting. A lot of detail, a lot of memorization. Is that perception changing?
I think the perception has to change because these machines, in particular the smart machines, machines that are using a lot of artificial intelligence, are actually bringing in also a lot of the emotional issues. Machines can read emotions. Machine can read faces. Machines will be able to support elderly, and hence they need a defined type of reading, of emotional reading. So I think the machines will be more human, but I also believe that the singularity, in other words, that these machines overcome or make it unnecessary to have humans is a wrong notion.
We have to obviously stay kind of ahead of what machines can do, and sort of understand, really understand the how they're put together, in order to make the most of them. Yeah.
That is absolutely necessary, and that's why we need people who study physics, people who understand mathematics, people who understand computers, in order to maintain the mastership, to be the master over the computers and not vice versa.
We just recently heard, we've been hearing a lot about smart cars, I know, and it's been one of the things that's been proposed for Honolulu. We also, you made a reference earlier to smart cities. What would that be?
Well, smart cities will be needed in order to maintain or generate sustainability for cities regarding energy provision, to have cities in which, for example, the traffic is seamlessly flowing. There is a town in Lithuania, and that town has a simple app, and that simple app tells every single individual where the next bus and when the next bus is leaving, so that it makes almost private cars unnecessary. So smart cities will do the utmost to keep the energy need requirement at a minimum, and smart cities will help every single person, also elderly who maybe are not able to orient themselves too well, to help them get around, find their ways around the city, but also make sure that they are being delivered the necessary groceries, milk, and whatnot.
All of that can be handled through through an artificial intelligence mechanism?
I believe so, and there are lots of approaches currently using AI, but not just AI, using also hardware that has to be installed in the cities, for example, a conductor that can charge a car without plugging it in. I think we are all aware that electrical cars will be probably in the big cities the only cars that will be running in 20 years from now. So you have to have the means to actually have them run, to have buses, have subways that then seamlessly connect the people. That's what I mean by smart cities. So the city itself is linked and has the means to provide everyone with every information that is necessary at any one moment.
So your advice to a student today would be to get behind science, technology, engineering, math education as much as you can.
Absolutely. I think science and technology is one of the most exciting disciplines in the sciences at all. We need the students. The students are required. I give you a simple number. When I looked up the employment structure in Silicon Valley, I discovered that about 50% of the PhDs that work in Silicon Valley are non-Americans. So there are two messages in it. One, of course, it's a highly attractive place, Silicon Valley. But the second is equally that we do not educate enough STM people in order to take on these jobs. So I think this field is a field that is of absolute need and is a great field for young people. And you can rest assured that these people will find jobs in this particular field in the years to come.
Do you think that other nations have outpaced us in STEM education?
I think this is definitely true. When I look at the country I'm originating from, Germany, we probably per capita produce most of the PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the problems, I think, in the United States. We have to make it more attractive in order to also train more people and bring these people or generate their interest to bring them into STEM.
Makes sense. I'm just wondering how you sell that to students, you know.
Well, I think there are good places in Hawaii. Like I know there is a teacher and advisor to the robotics program in Walalua High School, and they have a fantastic program in which they teach very young robotics and the elements of robotics. I was in South America and met like 14 years old. And these 14 years old were taught engineering, basics of engineering. And when I was talking to the class about at least 50% wanted to go in terms of their future profession into engineering. So it's a matter of motivating them, getting them interested in the respective fields.
So there's a good deal of hope in your perspective then.
I think it's a fantastic field, and it's more up to us, and it's up to the teachers, it's up to the universities in order to show them what this means for us and how exciting it can be if one works in that field. After all, engineering, biology, mathematics, each of these fields has a specific language, and all it takes is learn that language of the field.
Dr. Peter Gruss is the president and CEO of the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. He'll be the keynote speaker at a forum this Monday on science, engineering, and math entitled Views from the Cutting Edge. It's at the East-West Center on the UH Manoa campus. It begins at 1 p.m. It's free and open to the public.
Did you know that nearly 30% of the programming you hear on HPR 1 and HPR 2 is produced right here at our station?
From news stories on issues of local concern to talk programs that bring you local perspectives.
To local music hosts sharing their areas of expertise.
Hawaii Public Radio understands where you live. Connect with us and with your community.
Explore our local content via our website and mobile app.
It's now time for the Reality Check with our partners at Civil Beat. Joining us this morning is Anita Hofschneider, who talked with women who say they were subjected to unwanted advances by Speaker Emeritus Joe Suki. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning.
So did you have a hard time convincing those women to talk since they hadn't gone public with their complaints?
Yes, it's been difficult to collect these kinds of stories because there's so much shame and so much fear that's attached to them. You know, some of the anecdotes that I included in my story this week, I've had for a couple of months, but I haven't been able to publish because of, you know, concerns about them going forward. So it was because of the settlement that we decided that, it was okay to include them in this story.
So you talked with them prior to the settlement of this ethics complaint then?
Yes. After the news of Rachel Wong's complaint went public, many women wanted to start sharing their stories, but they weren't really sure how, and they were concerned about their names being attached. So I received some calls and spoke with some women who wanted to remain anonymous.
Right, and you said one was a lobbyist, one was a staffer. I mean, it just really kind of runs the gamut.
Yes, this behavior has allegedly affected staffers, lobbyists, and even lawmakers.
So what happens now? I mean, what's your sense? I think it was Associated Press reported that there have been a number of complaints against lawmakers. I think one in the Senate and the rest are in the House about, sexual harassment.
Well, we think that the Ethics Commission is looking into more complaints, although they can't confirm that. All of the complaints through the Ethics Commission are confidential. And the complaints internally in the House and Senate are also confidential. Just from talking to people, I know that there's more out there, but it takes a while for these stories to surface.
And so as far as Speaker Suki, you were at the news conference yesterday. What was your takeaway on that?
The news conference was very interesting because officially he's admitted to touching and kissing multiple women inappropriately beyond the boundaries of the customary aloha kiss. But at the news conference, he said he doesn't remember doing anything inappropriate. He said he's never done anything inappropriate to any woman in his life, either professionally or personally. So there were some conflicting statements.
Right, and he's supposed to step down by the end of this month, according to that settlement.
Yes, he has to resign by March 30th. He has to pay a $5,000 fine. He has to publicly apologize, which he also did yesterday. And I think there might be one more thing I might be forgetting, but you can see the full settlement on our website.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Anita. That was reporter Anita Hofschneider with today's Reality Check. Again, you can Read the full story at civilbeat.org.
Boys get the message at a young age, don't show your feelings, don't rely on anyone else. How do these messages affect them when they grow up?
One of the fixtures in the apartment was a post that runs floor to ceiling, and the post became my friend. I would hug the post. I would hug the post for all it was worth.
Rethinking what it means to be a man on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
It's called Oregon Saves, and some say Hawaii could too. It's a new way for small companies to help their workers save for retirement. AARP supports a bill modeled after Oregon's program, and AARP's national president, Eric Schneiderwin, joins us in the studio to talk about that bill, which is being heard this morning at the state capitol. Good morning.
Great to be here.
I'm sure you're warming up, right, because you're from Michigan.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you're here not really specifically for this bill, but what can you share about, you know, why you think this is so important?
Well, we know that a lot of people are approaching retirement and just don't have enough money. Some of the figures are just truly startling. The average family these days has about $2,500 of savings, and those approaching retirement only about $14,500. That's just not enough. I mean, the average Social Security benefit is a little bit more than $15,000 a year, and in a high-cost state like Hawaii, that won't cover very much at all.
Right.
So we know that people need to save more, and one of the most effective ways to save is workplace plans that deduct savings from payrolls automatically. And yet Hawaii has almost half of its workforce that doesn't have access to those programs. So Hawaii Saves is a legislative program, it's cleared the Senate, that would set up automatic payroll deduction plans. And that makes it literally 15 times more likely that people will save than without those plans.
Now, there is pushback from the insurance industry, and the State Department of Budget and Finance says, oh, hold on, not so fast, let's study this first.
Well, we're certainly happy to answer the questions they have, and obviously that's what the legislative process is really good about doing, is bringing out the questions and bringing out answers. But we think that Hawaii Saves, like the program in Oregon, like the program adopted in 8 other states, like the program under study in 30 other states, minimizes the burdens of administration and, just as important, really relieves the employer of any fiduciary duty or liability for the programs.
All right, and so we'll see how this progresses this session. But we are seeing our population age, and so there are lots of issues at the forefront that we really need to address before it's too late.
Yes. The aging of the population is something that we at AARP see certainly opportunities to use the service of these people, their experience as they age. But we need to anticipate some of the issues. For instance, another thing that we are looking at now and the legislature is looking at is making it easier for people to age in their homes and be cared for in their homes. It's what they want to do. It's far less expensive. So another piece of legislation is the Kupuna health care bill, Senate Bill 2988, which provides a small amount of assistance to caregivers, and that's what they often need, is like adult daycare, so the caregiver can go to work, earn a living, come home, and then care for their loved one. And that approach, making that kind of assistance available, is far, far less expensive than the almost $137,000 a year it would cost to have people cared for in nursing homes.
And you're here for a caregivers conference this weekend.
That's correct. We have a conference at the Japanese Culture Center on Saturday. It is fully subscribed, and that's a testimony to the criticality of the issue. But I do want to tell people on the air, I just recently helped a friend with caregiving issues, and we went to aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving, and got a wealth of information about how to access care resources, questions people need to have answered. And in addition to some of the guides we could print out, they actually have information on how to talk to a real human being and get real answers. So all that is available on aarp.org/caregiving.
And you can help navigate through Medicare, Medicaid issues as well.
It has some Medicare issues and references to agencies of government and resources that would help you get that information, yes.
And some might say, well, you know, some of these things are nice to do, but we can't afford it. Do you agree with
that?
Well,
I think society needs to take a look. For instance, right now, the Medicaid program provides two-thirds of the nursing home coverage for people. Very expensive coverage. They exhaust their resources. But that is a huge amount of money, and we can stretch that almost three times. We can take care of three people in their own home for the cost of taking care of one in a nursing home. So AARP has answers to that, you know, question of can we afford to take care of people as they age by doing it more efficiently and in the way they want.
So we can't afford not to do some of these things now.
That's exactly right. We can't afford not to save for retirement. We can't afford not to have programs that allow them to age in place in their own homes.
And so as far as these issues, I mean, you're speaking across the country about these concerns that you folks have. Given the climate in D.C. right now, how do you see these programs going forward?
I think Congress certainly is increasingly going to be looking at costs. Certainly they always have. And our approach to this is to outline means by which people can help themselves. They can help save. They can help take care of loved ones in their own home. And we have programs that really could make medical care less expensive, which would help everyone. And let me get right to the heart of the matter. The first place to start is drugs and the cost of drugs. We need to help reduce those costs. And we can start by having Medicare given negotiating authority. So just like the Veterans Administration and some other parts of Medicaid, they can negotiate with these drug companies and try to get the cost down. The other thing that we've done is work to help close a gap in Part D drug coverage under Medicare. And it used to be, and it is this year, that if you incur more than $3,750 of drug costs, the next $1,250 is all on you before the coverage kicks in. Well, we have worked on the program, and I'm happy to say that in 2019 that gap closes. And so people will not be exposed to those costs. So that's the kind of thing that we can do and we're prepared to do on a go-forward basis.
Okay, and I know that we've been hearing a lot about the concerns over healthcare costs, and this will not be the last. But again, concerns for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and we're going to have a little bit more on that tomorrow as well. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. That was AARP's National President Eric Schneiderwin talking about a way to allow small businesses to help their employees save for their golden years. Earlier in the show, we were in the Mo'ili'ili area looking at landmarks old and new. The area has a very rich sporting history, and many of you know, you probably still have fond memories of sitting in the Honolulu Stadium cheering for famous athletes like Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, and Jesse Owens. Popular entertainers Irving Berlin and Elvis Presley also performed there. And back in the stadium's heyday, large crowds would congregate at a nearby drive-in following football or baseball games, mostly teens who found it a great place to cruise and show off their souped-up cars. For those who went there for the food, the shrimp boat, ribeye, steak plate, and slush float were popular menu items. For today's quiz, we asked you to name that popular eatery that stood where the First Hawaiian Bank now sits. And according to HBR's digital producer Casey Harlow's dad, Chunky's Drive-In had the best fries in town.
And Catherine, a lot of people remembered that. Neil from Kaneohe was the first. He's our winner. He's got fond memories of the Termite Palace. And this was a popular quiz with lots of Chunky patrons calling in. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Career Center, where students can explore possible careers, get localized data, and understand expectations for those careers. Achieve3000.com.
Orchids aren't just a separate family of flowering plants. They're something approaching a cult. Orchid growers worldwide share a fascination with these diverse and beautiful flowers. There's something mysterious about them that even experts struggle to describe. Thomas Miranda is the Director of Horticulture, Education, and Outreach for the Hawaii Tropical Botanical Garden. He'll be offering a free talk on orchid diversity this weekend in Honolulu, and I asked him about the orchid mystique.
Orchids are truly masters of manipulation and deception. And a lot of people think that part of the reason we're so fascinated with them is because they're actually manipulating us. They do quite a bit of, you know, in order to attract pollinators, they often mimic other kinds of plants or sometimes even other, you know, even animals and insects. In order to get their pollination accomplished. There are those that say that the lip of certain orchids actually resembles part of the human anatomy that I will leave to your imagination, but seems to be extremely attractive to men, which is why so many men grow orchids, as well as women.
So you're describing them as kind of shapeshifters in a way.
Well, truly they are. One of the things that we found out in recent years about orchids is that just because the flower might look the same doesn't mean that the plants themselves are related. When we examine the DNA of orchid flowers, a lot of times plants that look very similar are not even closely related at all, but they have flowers that look alike because they're trying to attract a very specific kind of pollinator. And so oftentimes they will share pollinators based on the appearance of their flowers. So the way the flower looks has almost nothing to do with the plant's actual genetic relationships.
Are they very delicate plants or are they very hardy plants?
Well, most people complain that orchids are very, very fussy, difficult to grow as houseplants. Here at Hawaii Tropical Botanical Garden, orchids just, like, thrive. I mean, one of my gardeners jokes when he's asked, what he has to do to cultivate an orchid, he goes, well, I nail it to a tree and walk away. but, of course, for most people, that's not the case. Orchids are generally pretty tough plants. Most of them are, like, succulent, so they can... You know, they can handle, you know, not being watered all the time. Oftentimes they can handle a fairly low humidity situation if you're trying to grow one as a houseplant.
Mm-hmm.
There are some that I think part of the reason that people get into some trouble with them is that they think that, that their coffee table in the living room is orchid habitat.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. They need an area where they're getting adequate light and air movement and good quality water. All of these things come into play when you're trying to cultivate an orchid. I find them to be really tough, rather easy to grow plants, but other people, I'm sure, will disagree.
Is the Hawaii climate particularly congenial?
Oh, I think so. We have really excellent conditions, particularly here in the Big Island. But I think think all over the Hawaiian Islands, we don't experience a whole lot of really cold weather. We don't, the plants sort of thrive in tropical temperatures. The majority of orchids love to be around, 75 to 80 degrees during the day and 60, 65 degrees at night. So most of the climate of the islands, depending on what elevation you're at, are really ideal for a lot of orchids. Some prefer to be much warmer. Others prefer to be really cool, particularly orchids that originate in high mountain areas. Just in the same way, depending on what island you live on and what elevation you're at, there are actually different kinds of orchids that would do well there. A lot of people on Oahu do better with hotter, drier orchids, mm-hmm. whereas a lot of people here in Hilo, do better with upper elevation, cloud forest type orchids.
There's an awful lot of information available about them, isn't there? I mean, it's been studied for so long because of that very fascination.
Yeah, people have been fascinated with orchids for over 200 years, and that's just counting, Western culture. In their native habitats, people have been growing and collecting orchids since ancient times. There's actually books that were written by Chinese scholars over 1,000 years ago about how to grow cymbidiums, and I think that if you find indigenous cultures in South America, they were using orchids medicinally and using them in ceremonial things for, probably thousands of years.
It sounds as if there's a great deal yet to be learned about orchids.
Okay, there's probably, no one really knows the exact number because they're still actually discovering new orchids as they go into various unexplored regions in the world. But there's probably close to 30,000 species of orchids that actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
The orchid field is so vast that there's really no way that you can know it all. And all of them have their own story. All of them have their own special ecology. They often have species-specific pollinators. They have relationships with mycorrhizal fungi, which is a whole world that hardly any of us know anything about. They're highly interdependent organisms with their environment. So a lot of people talk about conserving orchid species, and really the best way to do that is, of course, to conserve habitats because they're so interwoven with everything around them. Most of them are what we call epiphytes, mm-hmm. actually living on trees. And so their whole existence is dependent on there being a forest there. The forest is gone. There's no orchids there.
We see that with so many species, especially in Hawaii, don't we?
Absolutely. Hawaii actually does not have very many native orchids. I believe there's only three,
mm-hmm.
And they're all terrestrial species, which are very, very interesting, particularly their distribution. It's very, very odd. I mean, one of them, the closest relative, is from the Aleutians. Another one, the closest relative, is in Asia. And another one, really oddly, its closest relative is on the east coast of North America.
Yeah.
So we have this amazing, weird distribution of the Hawaiian natives. Now, to say, that there are so few native orchids in Hawaii is kind of ironic because the Big Island in particular has been christened the Orchid Island.
Yeah.
Some of the best orchid growers in the world are here, and they grow absolutely astonishingly well because of the climate that we have. So even though the orchids aren't native, we have like the perfect climate for so many species. It's really astounding.
For you as a scientist, the very fact that there's still mystery about them has to be a big part of what keeps you going, I would think.
Oh, it absolutely does. I would say that that my fascination has never waned in 30 years of studying them. In fact, it just gets more and more strange and wonderful every 5 minutes. There's just so much diversity and stuff to learn about them.
Thomas Miranda is the Director of Horticulture, Education, and Outreach for the Hawaii Tropical Botanical Garden on the Big Island. He'll be offering a free talk on orchid diversity at 3 p.m. Saturday as part of the weekend-long 64th Annual Kunia Orchid Show and Plant Sale at Leilahua High School. You can get details on our Facebook page. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll sit down with Surgeon General Vice Admiral Jerome Adams to talk about the opioid epidemic. And we'll talk about addiction treatment in Hawaii with Hina Mauka's Alan Johnson.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoot.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.